Good morning. It's good to be here with you this morning. Jack, I appreciate your reading of Titus 2 earlier. That is where we'll start this morning. And I want to focus in on one specific word that is found in that passage, and that is the word sober. In the New King James Version, that word, that term is found in some form or another three times in that passage. The first instance is in verse 2, where the older men are instructed to be sober. The next instance we see a similar instruction to younger men. They are told to be sober-minded. And then lastly of all, we have in verses 11 and 12, where it says, "For the grace of God that brings salvation has appeared to all men, teaching us that denying ungodliness and worldly lusts, we should live soberly, righteously, and godly in the present age." And if we were even to back up into chapter 1, we would see that sober is a qualification for the eldership as well. And this is a fairly short letter that Paul wrote to Titus, and we have here at least four times this word is used as a characteristic to describe a characteristic that Christians should have. Now, in our society, we have a very specific use for the term sober. When you hear of the term sober, what do you associate with that? Substance abuse is typically what we think of. The term sober in our society is used to describe a person who is free from the influences of alcohol and drugs. And this is certainly an appropriate use of this term. I don't want this to come across as one of those instances where we say that this term has been hijacked by our society, a Christian term, because I don't think that's the case here at all. A sober mind is a mind that is unimpeded by outside influence. And in the case that we normally use it in everyday life, it's used to describe somebody who isn't influenced by alcohol or drugs. They have a sober mind. I mean, you know, it's been proven by science, but one does not have to be a scientist to know that certain drugs and alcohol have a dulling effect on the mind. You can see it simply by observing people who are under the influence. It slows down motor skills, speech can become slurred, rational thinking and effective decision making are reduced. It really does cloud the mind. But I don't think this is specifically what Paul was writing about when he wrote to Timothy. I think it could apply. But I think Paul was writing in a much broader term than this, because there's a lot of different things out there that can cloud our minds, that can get in the way of good rational thinking. It could be sin or the temptation to sin. More specifically, it could be things like selfishness or pride or prejudice, jealousy, envy. It could even be emotions. Emotions can absolutely wreak havoc on our ability to make good decisions, to think clearly. Jeremiah chapter 17 verse 9 tells us that the heart is deceitful above all things and is desperately wicked. Who can know it? The heart, the part of our body that is commonly identified with the emotional side of our body, is said here to be deceitful. The heart will fool you. Things like anger and jealousy and even love can impact our minds in ways that can have a negative effect on us being able to make clear, rational decisions. So there are a lot of things that can get in our head and make it difficult to make good decisions. And I think that's where this term sober comes in. How it is used here in Titus and how we see it used several times throughout the New Testament is to describe someone whose mind is unclouded. A sane and moderate mind, someone who is circumspect. They're aware of their surroundings, not necessarily in a physical way, but they perceive what is happening in and around their lives. They see temptation, they perceive temptation, and they view it for what it is. They can see and look past their own selfishness, their pride, their jealousy, or their envy. They're calm and dispassionate, and not inappropriately swayed by their emotions. It is an individual who is self-controlled, who curbs their own desires and impulses. They battle the outside influences of the world, the weakness of their flesh, and the fragility of their mind to make good godly decisions. And I think that's what he's talking about in using the term sober. The language that Paul uses in Titus chapter 2, specifically in verse 12, indicates that sobriety should be an active part of our Christian lifestyle. It says there that we should live soberly, righteously, and godly in the present age. It's not simply an action, but a lifestyle. Consider the other terms that follow that term sobriety there. Righteously and godly words that we're probably more familiar with than soberly as it's used here in the Bible. Righteousness and godliness are not established by one single act on any given day. Those things are lifestyles as well. Righteousness, to live righteously is to devote yourself to doing what is right in the eyes of God. To be godly, we have to be committed to live how God has commanded us. They require our continual attention, our continual effort. And sobriety is the same. It is a way of life that demands our continual attention and our continual effort. It requires that we are mindful of how we think, of how we act, and how we react. And this is difficult because we are continually bombarded and we are continually tempted to make the impulse decision. We are continually encouraged by the world to follow our hearts and to succumb to the temptations of the flesh. We're certainly not encouraged to stop and consider our actions. And in a lot of ways, our mind is actually geared towards making the impulse decision. Our mind, by nature, tends to take the easier course. It wants to make the impulse decision, which isn't always bad, and we'll get into that a little bit later. But in his book, Thinking Fast and Slow, the writer Daniel Kahneman divides the work of the mind into two systems. He logically labels them System 1 and System 2, and he labels System 1 as the system that operates automatically, with little or no effort and no sense of voluntary control. It's things like intuition, when you talk about intuition. That's System 1. System 2, on the other hand, allocates attention to mental activities require effort associated with agency, choice, and concentration. And that's where things like belief and reason and logic reside. So if you've actually stopped to think about something, you have engaged System 2. System 1 is more of the impulse. It's like when you're driving your car, the person in front of you puts their brakes on. You automatically, without thinking, put your brakes on. And what psychologists have found is that our mind relies predominantly on System 1, the impulse and automatic reaction part of the brain. It's the part that's always running. System 2, on the other hand, is only engaged at a high level when System 1 engages it. And I don't want to get too mired down in the psychology here, but to make my point, our minds, your mind, my mind, is always going to try to take what it perceives as the easy way out unless we engage it further. It is always going to want to make the impulse decision unless we make ourselves think it through. A verse that I seem to go back to frequently in my lessons and my study is found in 1 Peter chapter 1 and verse 13. Where it reads there, "Therefore gird up the loins of your mind, be sober, and rest your hope fully upon the grace that is to be brought to you at the revelation of Jesus Christ." And I've always really liked this verse because it's an idiom here that Peter uses to describe what we should be doing with our minds as Christians. And to put this into some context, the clothes that were worn during the time of this writing consisted really of three separate garments. There was one undergarment that covered the waist region. And then basically there was a robe that went over that. And for men, it would go down to the knees. And for women, it would go down to the ankles. And then there was a belt that wrapped around the waist to kind of tie it all together. And the idea of girding up your loins was that you girded up the loins of your garment. You picked them up and you tucked them into your belt. And it's an idiom that brings to mind the ability, the process of getting to work. That's what people would do back then when they were going to work hard, was they tucked the bottom of their garments into their belt. And so when Peter is telling us to gird up the loins of our mind, he is telling us to prepare ourselves because there is a difficult task at hand, deserving of our utmost attention and effort, our utmost diligence. Prepare your mind and get it ready because you have work to do. And then he then instructs them to be sober. And I like this progression. There's a progression that Peter is using here. Get your mind ready. Be sober. Don't allow your mind to be clouded and obstructed. And then he progresses to the idea of resting our hope fully upon the grace that is to be brought to you by the revelation of Jesus Christ. Have clarity and focus on your hope, on the grace that you have been afforded through Jesus Christ. A sober mind is one that removes all distractions and focuses clearly on this hope. And Peter, once again later on in this letter, highlights the importance of this sobriety in our life and the effect that it can have over in chapter 5 and verse 8. In that passage, he provides us with the reason for our need for sobriety, where he writes, "Be sober, be vigilant, because your adversary, the devil, walks about like a roaring lion, seeking whom he may devour." Peter's admonition to be sober is clearly or directly related to our ability to resist the devil. Temptation is a constant companion for us. It follows us wherever we go. And as Jesus demonstrated, we could go into the wilderness for 40 days and still have temptation follow us. No matter where we go, it will be there. We can be by ourselves in the middle of nowhere like Jesus was, and temptation will be our companion there. In 1 John chapter 2 and 16, John sums up sin and temptation by calling it the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life. So this continual temptation we have seeks to seduce us by what feels good, by what looks good, by what puffs up. But temptation is a lie. It is always a lie. It is a deception. In John chapter 8 and verse 44, Jesus says, "You are of your father the devil, and the desires of your father you want to do. He was a murderer from the beginning and does not stand in the truth, because there is no truth in him. When he speaks a lie, he speaks from his own resources, for he is a liar and the father of it." Every temptation we face comes from Satan, and every temptation we face is a lie. It promises us fulfillment and never delivers. Sin offers short-term emotional or physical relief at the expense of long-term spiritual consequences. Where sobriety comes in is in the ability to see through the lies and fight the cloud that is caused by the temptations, to fight the things that look good to our eyes, the things that pull at our flesh. We recognize the lie for what it is. And I think the best example we have in this regard is certainly Jesus Christ, as I've alluded to already in the passage where he's tempted in the wilderness. And I won't be turning to that passage, but in Matthew chapter 4, we have this recorded, as in some other places in the scriptures. And just imagine for a minute the challenge that Jesus would be facing here as he has Satan come to him after 40 days of fasting in the wilderness. Think of the things that would obstruct his thinking, the pull of his flesh would have on him. Think of how hungry he was. I haven't gone 40 days without eating. I'm not sure if I've gone a day without eating, with the exception of maybe being sick, and then you don't want to eat. So I can't imagine what the feeling would be like of being without food for 40 days. And here is Satan tempting him to turn this rock into bread. You'll prove that you're the Son of God, and you'll have something to eat. And the second temptation, think of how comforting it would be for Jesus to know that God would hold to his promises. And that's where Satan tells him to cast himself off this cliff so that the angels would come and rescue him from his fall, to prove to Jesus that God was there for him. "I'll just throw myself off the rocks and see if he is true to his word." And the last temptation, think of how much work he knew. Jesus knew he had ahead of him to establish his kingdom. And here is Satan offering him all the kingdom of the world, all the kingdoms of the world, if only Jesus would bow down and worship him right there. But what we see Jesus doing is looking to the scriptures and looking to reality, seeing past the lie and looking to the truth. There is something more important than the bread on this earth. Tempting God is unacceptable. It is a sin. And lastly, that no one should be worshipped but the Lord your God. So Jesus was able to look past the temptation. He managed to overcome the pulls of the flesh, and he looked to the scriptures to see the lie, to know the truth, and anchored himself to that. And that is sobriety. Mind not distracted by the lies, but anchored strongly and securely to the truth. And that can be so hard for us because temptation will push us to suppress the truth and buy into the lie, and it does it at our weakest moments. But Jesus gives us a great example. He shows us the importance of finding those anchors to hold on to, truths that we can go back to in order to maintain our focus. And let's turn back over to 1 Peter chapter 1. I want to look at the verses that follow verse 13. And I want to read verses 13 through 17 here real quick. Actually, I'll pick up in 14 since we've already read verse 13. "As obedient children, not conforming yourselves to the former lusts as in your ignorance, but as he who has called you is holy, you also be holy in all your conduct, because it is written, 'Be holy, for I am holy.' And if you call on the Father, who without partiality judges according to each one's work, conduct yourselves throughout the time of your stay here in fear. So the center purpose of this passage seems to be an admonition to change and to grow. And I think verse 16 really wraps it up concisely for us, where it says, "Be holy, for I am holy." And so that's what our admonition here is to do. That's why he started off with this idea of being sober, because we're trying to strive for a holiness, a change, to conform ourselves to Jesus Christ. And in verses 18 and 19, I think Peter gives us one of those truths, one of those anchors that we can hold ourselves to in order to help resist temptation. In verse 18 of the New King James Version, it starts with the word knowing. So we're talking about doing all the things that he talked about here in verses 14 through 17, actually 13 through 17, knowing the following. And this is what he says here: knowing that you were not redeemed with corruptible things like silver or gold from your aimless conduct received by traditions from your fathers, but with the precious blood of Christ, as a lamb without blemish and without spot. So Peter, as he's telling us to grow and to change and to be holy, is telling us to focus on the cost of our redemption. The cost of our redemption wasn't with gold or silver. It wasn't with material things. It wasn't with things that would fade away. It was with nothing less than the blood of Jesus Christ. And that's something that we can hold on to. When temptation is bearing down, we can look to this. The sin that I'm about to commit, Jesus gave his life to cover these sins. Do I really need to waste the blood of Jesus Christ on this? Think of what was given to cover this sin, and do I really want to go through with it so I can have my moment of fun, to obtain a fleeting and shallow comfort? Now there's a reason that Paul wrote in Philippians chapter 4, verse 8, for us to meditate on things that are true and noble, just and pure, lovely, things that are of good report and things that have virtue and are praiseworthy. We meditate on these things, those things and things like the cost of our redemption, because it helps us to stay focused on God. It allows us to keep our mind sober, to keep those other things from taking up space in our mind and clouding our judgment. Meditate on those. Find the truths in the scriptures that you can anchor yourself to, and use that to keep your mind sober. I think sobriety requires, in order to live a sober life and have a sober mind, I think it requires that we recognize just how fragile our mind is. Our mind is so easily influenced. And there was a psychological study done that I think really illustrates, it was kind of shocking to me, how easily the mind is influenced. And you'll have to forgive me. I took notes when I read this some years ago, and I didn't reference where I found it from, so I can't tell you where I actually read this study from. I looked all over the place for it, and I couldn't find it. But I think I have all the details correct. And in this study, they took several groups of individuals, and they put them in a room. And as a group, they were to watch this commercial. And half the groups they had were watching a commercial for, if I remember correctly, some kind of a spa, some kind of a place where people were relaxing, they were taking it easy, they were in a nice, calm environment. And the other half of the groups watched an advertisement for a gym or something where people were highly active. They were playing racquetball or basketball, they were moving around, they were running around, they were just very active in the commercial. And after those commercials were shown, the groups were told that down the hallway from the room they were in was a kitchen, and that kitchen were refreshments, and they were directed to walk down to the kitchen. And what the people who were doing the study did was they timed how long it took these groups to walk from their room down to the room with the refreshments. And what they found was that the people who watched the relaxing commercial took much more time to walk down the hallway than the people who watched the commercial where people were active. It took them a lot more time to walk down there. So the people who were active subconsciously walk to this place faster because they had watched this video. And I find that fascinating. Now, obviously, this isn't a study about temptation and sin, but it does illustrate how easily our mind is influenced. A video these people watched affected their walking speed. They had no idea, and they had no idea this happened. And if that can happen, just think about all the things that surround us, both voluntarily that surround us and involuntarily, that can affect our behavior, even in the slightest ways. We have to have a sober mind about the things that we decide to do and subject ourselves to, because these things will have an effect on our mind and we won't even know it if we're not cautious. We also have to understand that the decisions that we make will affect our ability to make the right decision in the future. You know, I've often wondered in the scriptures, what was the difference between Joseph and David? Why did Joseph flee his master's wife when she grabbed his garment? While David, on the other hand, when he saw Bathsheba, he lingered, he coveted, he stole, he committed adultery, and he murdered after he saw her on the roof. And I don't know the answer to that question, and I don't want to speculate because that won't give me get us any closer to the real answer. But I wouldn't be surprised if it had to do with their decisions prior to that point. So often it seems that the sin isn't the result of one decision, but it is the result of many decisions prior to that. It's like we're simply priming the starter to make a bad decision in the future. And I think you can see this throughout the scriptures. I think one example that we have, I'll just point out one example, is Cain. If Cain would have brought an acceptable sacrifice to God, he probably wouldn't have ended up killing his brother Abel. Even after that point, when he brought the bad sacrifice to God, or the unacceptable sacrifice to God, if he would have repented of that offense and not have been angry with his brother, he probably wouldn't have killed Abel there either. But the decisions that he made prior to that, offering the unacceptable sacrifice, not being accepting of the condemnation that God had on him for giving that unacceptable sacrifice, being angry with his brother, led him to the point where he's making the decision of whether or not to kill his brother. Now, he could have turned back at any point in time, but he proceeded to kill his brother. And that mistake was primed partially by his earlier decision. Now, admittedly, that's an extreme example, but it illustrates the cumulative effect of sin. Sin will oftentimes more than not lead to more sin. And sometimes just bad decisions lead to sin. Something that might not even seem so bad, something that might not even be sin itself, leads to something else, which then leads to something else, and the next thing you know, you're holding a club over your brother's head. Proverbs chapter 22 and verse 3 reads, "A prudent man foresees evil and hides himself, but the simple pass on and are punished." So a prudent man sees evil and hides himself from evil. Conquering temptation and evil is not always about strength. It is many times about wisdom. Looking ahead to see where evil is. Looking ahead that we may avoid and hide from it, or at the very least be preparing for it. And there are things that we can do to help. We can, in essence, train our conscience. And this is back where we were earlier talking about the concepts of our mind having two systems. The first system is the impulse system, the quick reaction. The second system is the one where the brain really engages to think and to reason. And while I did place a lot of emphasis on engaging that second system and being sober-minded, the beauty of the first system is that it can be trained to react in the appropriate way. Think for a minute of a master chess player. A master chess player can sit down at any random board in any random part of the game, and he can just look at it, and he can see several moves ahead. He can see, if I do this, then what's likely to happen is this, and then this will happen, and then this will happen, and this will happen, and then it's check. He can see that just by looking at the board. Now, I, on the other hand, if I look at a chess board, I can see, like, a move ahead. And what's the difference between me and him? Well, the difference is that he studied the game. He studied it in such a way and engaged himself in such a way that now his impulses will a lot of times drive his reaction, because he can look at it and just automatically see what is going on. And we all have things like this in our life. We all have things that we've trained our mind that we have intuition now for it. There's any number of examples that we can look at. An accountant will be able to look at a tax return and automatically make judgments about that tax return that somebody else may not. I find it amazing how nurses can just look at people and be able to tell many things about them just by the way they look, because they've engaged with so many different people who are sick that their mind has been trained to notice certain things about people's skin color. I don't know what it is, but they can look at it and just see. And we all have things like that in our lives. And that is that system one that has been trained to know what to look for. Well, we can do the exact same thing with our spiritual minds. We can be the prudent man and foresee evil. We can train our minds to look at a scenario and see that we want no part of it. But in order to do that, we cannot be distracted. Our minds have to be sober. Not distracted by the world, not distracted by temptation, but focused on the Lord, focused on His will, and focused on His sacrifice. So one more passage I want to go to this morning in relation to sobriety. Let's turn over to Romans chapter 12. I just want to pull a couple points from this, and then we'll close our lesson this morning. I'm going to be considering most of the chapter here, but I'm not going to take the time to read it, so hopefully I can highlight the points throughout this, and would encourage you to go through and read this on your own at a later time. In verse 3 of this chapter, Paul wrote, "For I say, through the grace given to me to everyone who is among you, not to think of himself more highly than he ought to think, but to think soberly, as God has dealt to each one a measure of faith." Now this verse directly follows two verses that are talking about transforming ourselves and renewing our mind, and they're directly before a series of verses on finding our place within a congregation, how we can contribute to a congregation, and then going on to talk about loving without hypocrisy and being kindly affectionate to one another. And then here in the middle of this scripture is a verse about self-examination, to take a sober examination of yourself. And he says, writes there very specifically, not to think too highly of yourself. Take away the pride, the vanity, and maybe even in contrast, take away the self-demeaning. A lot of us can get down on ourselves, and instead of thinking of ourselves in a very high way, we can think of ourselves automatically in a very low way. But he's encouraging us here to take a good, honest look at ourselves. And it's logical of how this is important for the subject material that we find in the first two verses and in the verses that follow. The idea of being a living sacrifice and transforming ourselves, and also looking at ourselves to find out what place we have in a congregation. Because evaluating ourselves in that process does require a sober mind. Asking yourself the question, am I being a living sacrifice, requires that we have a sober mind in order to answer that question. Self-evaluation is always difficult because we either want to see all the good in ourselves or we want to see all the bad in ourselves. And we have to remove all that and look at ourselves in a very sober way. And the verses that follow continue with this thought of sober self-reflection and how it relates to our role in our congregation and our relationships. The first few verses down to verse 8 are about understanding our place in the congregation, what our role is, and how we can personally contribute. And Paul here is telling us to look at this with a sober mind. The questions such as, am I doing enough? Am I doing what I should be doing? Am I using the gifts that God has given me? What gifts has God given me to use? And he's wanting us to take an honest, sober look at this question. Get rid of all the noise. Don't worry about what other people are doing or not doing. Simply focus on yourself. And then in verses 9 through the end of the chapter, we have passages that have a lot to do with our relationships with one another. Instructions about loving without hypocrisy, being kindly affectionate towards one another, giving preference to one another, repay no one evil for evil. And these are all about our relationships. And all these instructions, even the ones in these verses that do not speak to our relationship, they all require a sober mind. Love without hypocrisy. Now that requires a sober mind. Relationships can be difficult. It's easy for us to be offended by other people, oftentimes even when no offense was meant. It's easy for us to get caught up into things. Things people did that hurt us in some way or aggravated us in some way. And then you begin to view people in an unfair light. And it's difficult to talk about it in any specificity because there are countless of ways this can happen. But what I would encourage for us all to do is be sober-minded in whatever situation we find ourselves. Examine ourselves with a sober mind to determine whether or not maybe you are the issue. Have a sober mind about dealing with an individual, dealing with others. Always be working towards what Paul writes here, giving preference to one another. Be affectionate. Do not repay evil for evil. And let these instructions be our guidance as opposed to our emotions and our pride. And here it is again, having these truthful anchors that we can hold ourselves to. We're looking at any situation, remembering to give preference to one another, to be kindly affectionate. Hold to these things. I'll end my lesson on sobriety here, and I hope I provided something that encouraged or edified you. And at the very least, I hope what you'll do is notice this word more often when it comes up in Scripture, and maybe give it some additional thought in your own time. At this time, we're going to offer the gospel invitation. If there's anyone here who would like to give their life over to Jesus Christ, or if there's any way else that this congregation can, or if there's anything else this congregation can do to assist you, we invite you to come forward as we stand and sing the invitation number that Paul announced.